I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Jason Hartwig. He is a security sector reform professional. Not sure what that means. Most recently, he worked for the U.S. mission to Somalia as a military assistance coordinator and previously was in the U.S. Army as an armor officer in Iraq War II and Afghanistan. Here he's got this important piece at waronthrocks.com. How to end the civil war in Somalia. Give away the conclusion in the headline. Negotiate with Al-Shabaab. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jason?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
You know what? I'm really happy to have you on the air here and happy to see this article. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone, or more than on the kind of libertarian fringe maybe, say, hey, let's not have a war in Somalia anymore. I guess most people don't even know we have one at all. But it's been about 13 years now. And I think you're saying here what probably the American people, if they knew much about it anyway, would feel like. But you're finally saying what was unsayable maybe a few years ago, out loud, plain as day. We can't defeat this Al-Shabaab group, so let's deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, so people have been saying there's been a couple pieces recently that have come out, you know, as we're opening negotiations with the Taliban, pointing out that maybe we should negotiate with Al-Shabaab. As well, I actually kind of framed my initial draft of the piece like that, and the reviewer rightly pointed out there's a lot of incongruencies in the comparison between the Taliban and Al-Shabaab, and so it sort of drops that comparison. What may be new is someone who's sort of seen behind the curtain and been part of the policy process on the U.S. side coming out and saying we probably ought to change course. But at the same time, I mean, I think you raise a good point that there has been a bit of a sea change, and that obviously, you know, 2 to 4 years ago, saying something this like this would be heresy, and I'd be a professional pariah, and maybe I still will be, but I'm leaving for the academy anyway, so that kind of liberated me to say exactly what I thought.
You know what it is too is, well, first of all, obviously your experience here, as you say. But, you know, it's just the calendar. You look at it, it's almost 2020, and even David Petraeus would have to admit the war on terrorism, as conceived and implemented by these men, has not worked on its own terms. So here we are. I mean, Al-Shabaab only declared their loyalty to Al-Qaeda a few years into the war anyway, right? They ain't gone yet. So it seems it's fair enough. It should be fair enough for anyone, whatever their experience, any citizen of this country, to question whether any of this should be continuing on a status quo basis the way it is now. As McChrystal had advised about Afghanistan, just keep muddling through forever.
Sure. So, I mean, I think there's, in the Somali context, there's three things, you know, sort of drew us to Somalia, why we're engaged in Somalia. And first and most important, if you're looking at terms of national interest, is Somalia is located in a very strategic location in the world. It's got one of the longest, not the longest coastline in Africa, and, you know, essentially can act as a choke point to the Suez Canal and the Red Sea. So you're seeing increased military competition in Djibouti, which was once a part of Somalia. And, you know, ethnically, the inhabitants of Djibouti are all Somali. So, you know, there's competition between the Chinese and U.S. there, and escalation of building bases, piracy in Somalia from 2007 to 2012 was an enormous problem of international shipping that eventually brought about a large naval task force, part of which is funded by the EU and still it's the EU naval force is still off the coast of Somalia. So there's that national interest piece. Then secondarily, there's, you know, what I sort of point out of the crusading ideology of the war on terror, where anything that looked like terrorism was declared terrorism. And we kind of lumped insurgencies that had, I would argue, more localized concerns in with, you know, sort of corporate al-Qaeda. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, you and I would kind of agree. And there's the third point, which is the sort of humanitarian concerns. And that's, you know, if you go back to Black Hawk Down, you know, the reason that we initially got involved in Somalia was this enormous famine. And Somalia is always sort of teetering on the brink of famine. I mean, just 2 years ago when I was there, we were able to stave off famine that could have been very severe. In 2012, it was really awful. And that's what accounts for a lot of the fatalities in Somali conflict. And then, you know, because of civil war, there's a lot of negative externalities associated with it. So, Kenya right now hosts the largest refugee camp in the world, in Dadaab. Both Ethiopia and Kenya have enormous Somali populations that, you know, when conflict is ongoing in Somalia, that spills over to Kenya and Ethiopia, two of the largest trading partners the U.S. has in Africa. So, I mean, those are the things that brought us there. My argument is that it's this weird, just using the wrong lens to think about the problems, that we're looking at the symptom, which is terrorism, that al-Shabaab is using regionally. And, you know, I don't really think there's much of a threat against the homeland, but, I mean, if you can make that argument that maybe there's a small threat of an al-Shabaab attack on the homeland, partially because we're involved in a war there. And instead, we should be thinking about it as a civil war. And, you know, in the piece, I sort of lay out, there's three ways the civil war goes. There's decisive victory, which, honestly, is what you kind of hope for, that has the lowest chance of recurrence. You know, when one side sort of crushes the other, think of like our civil war, everything's kind of said and done, and the winner imposes the rule. It's a victor's peace, and that peace generally tends to last longer and is more stable. You know, or the conflict can muddle along, in which case we certainly have continued terrorism from al-Shabaab. Or you can negotiate an end to the conflict. And right now, Somalia actually has a lot of the ingredients that go towards a decent negotiated settlement. We have essentially a mutually hurting stalemate. Neither side is strong enough to win. There is an enormous international peacekeeping force. It's actually more of a peacemaking force. It's a war fight. It has a warfighting mandate funded by and troops provided by the African Union. It's funded by the EU. So there's 20,000 African troops, you know, from five troop contributing countries currently fighting in Somalia. If they folded over into peacekeeping with a robust mandate, that's one of the first ingredients you have to having sustainable, stable settlement there. So, you know, I think part of it is we just need to realize that there are differences in insurgencies that use terrorism, and we can't treat everyone as sort of al-Qaeda circa, you know, 2006 or 2007. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in other words, terrorism is a tactic, not some malevolent supreme being out there that we're fighting
right,
against.
Exactly. Okay.
All right, now, so let me see here. There's so many different things to pick up on, but first of all, I guess I want to ask you now about support for the government that the U.S. really has created in Mogadishu there, and, you know, I guess if you want, maybe compare it to Afghanistan as far as whether you think it can stand without foreign support, whether it really has any form of kind of popular sovereignty, or is it just a foreign imposed creature? I know you say in the article there's really no question that al-Shabaab is really just like the Taliban. They're a much more welcome security force among the population, at least a certain part of the population where they're embedded, than the people that the Americans say are the new democratic, you know, glorious leaders of the future.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think, you know, the point that I often made is if you pulled AMISOM, you know, the African Union mission in Somalia out, so those, you know, 22,000 at the time, now, you know, a little over 20,000 troops, I mean, al-Shabaab would be in Mogadishu very quickly. So, yeah, I don't think the federal government would be able to stand on its own. A significant portion of key members of the government hold, second passports. So I think they would probably jet pretty quickly. The president of Somalia right now is a U.S. citizen and was working in the Department of Transportation in Buffalo before he was elected president.
Yeah. But what does that say about their ability to negotiate if al-Shabaab is in a position of strength and they're in a position of really none without foreign support?
Well, that's what kind of tips the scales, and that's why you move towards a negotiated settlement, because al-Shabaab can't win with foreign support. And for a lot of the rattling that the troop contributing countries from Amisom make, so say Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Burundi, that they want to leave, they're benefiting immensely from these deployments. They use a lot of the EU funding to essentially fund either part or all of their military spending. So I think one of the problems may be down the road getting Amisom to leave. So there's going to be these foreign troops there for a while, and al-Shabaab essentially can't win as long as they're there. Right. And al-Shabaab is absolutely hurting from the drone campaign. I make the statement there that, sure, there's, you're not going to win with it, but you're killing a lot of these leaders. And then also, al-Shabaab is really an amorphous group. There's a large scale of Somali business interests that are involved in al-Shabaab. I mean, one of the interesting things in Somalia is it's very entrepreneurial, country very entrepreneurial society. The business community is actually rather socially conservative. And so al-Shabaab's predecessor, the Islamic Courts Union, partially came to power because the Somali business community kind of threw in with them. Because one, there was an alignment ideologically, and then two, the point I make that this Islamist group was able to provide more predictable and cheaper security. Mm-hmm. And so the business community kind of went along with them. So, the business community has some interest in continued conflict in Somalia because corruption is so rampant that's I think the security dollars being fueled into Somalia is partially what drives the intensity of the conflict. And if you start to take that out, you would reduce the conflict. But also, these are businessmen. They're willing to make a deal, and there's going to be fighting as part of that negotiation. I think it wouldn't surprise me, and obviously it wouldn't surprise me if I made the argument that Shabaab, at least significant elements of it, would be willing to deal. There may be some irreconcilables. They would probably go off and join the Islamic State. But the Islamic State has, last estimates from the UN was something like 400 or 500 fighters running around in North Somalia. They're really not a significant threat.
And they're really just al-Shabaab guys who changed their brand name anyway, right?
The most part. I'm not an expert on that, but that is my understanding.
Can you contrast then with the Taliban? And the Taliban have said all this time that, look, we're just going to wait you out. You have to leave eventually, and we demand you leave eventually. And those are our only conditions, essentially, or we'll keep fighting. But you're saying these guys are more willing to negotiate than that. Because the balance is they're the ones right in the now, position so. Of strength. Why give up now?
I don't think that they're in – it's a stalemate right now. My argument is you can't necessarily take away the variable of external support.
I understand that, but I just mean if it's a stalemate with one side being the guerrilla force and the other side being foreign supported, then really it's advantage to the guerrillas, even if it's essentially a stalemate in the middle, right? You know what I mean?
It could be. Absolutely.
I want a peaceful solution to this thing. I'm not trying to poke holes in your theory here. I'm just trying to understand, how it is really that Shabaab could be coaxed into negotiating now when it seems like they don't really have to.
Well, the point I made in the piece is, the solution to help her is a little bit of the same in that, increased military pressure, provide guarantees that external forces are going to remain. But something that's never been offered to al-Shabaab is actually a chance to enter the government. So I think one of the problems the U.S. in particular often has when we discuss negotiations, and I saw this when I was in Afghanistan in the Army in 2010, is when we talk negotiations, it was like we're winning, and they're going to kind of surrender to us, and we're going to negotiate their surrender, and we're going to figure out amnesty, and we're going to figure out how to, you know, sort of reincorporate them into society. My argument is, no, like, they're essentially another government that you're negotiating what a coalition government will look like. Now, I mean, there's some really negative stuff that could be associated with that. Human rights and women's rights are probably going to be thrown by the wayside. I mean, that's a question in the United States, and I didn't really have time in the piece to get into it, but that's an internal discussion that we need to have, and that we are having a bit in Afghanistan. And, my guess is behind closed doors, everyone's kind of like, well, you know, we're going to have to put women's rights and human rights piece on the back burner in order to achieve peace. Mm-hmm.
By the way, for my footnote, because I'm going to quote you later, what year you're talking about when the Army's conception was, here's how we're going to negotiate their surrender?
Well, I mean, I think how the military has always thought. I mean, that's kind of counterinsurgency theory.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it sounds exactly like, you know, what they said about Afghanistan as well, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but I just mean, could you give me like circa time frame for that
program? I mean, so the idea is, well, I mean, that when I was in Afghanistan, they were talking about that in 2010. I mean, that's sort of Richard Holbrooke.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant that in terms of Somalia as well, or that anecdote with Somalia.
Yeah. I mean, in Somalia,
it's my fault. I keep skipping back and forth between the wars.
Yeah.
It's not your fault. Sorry.
So there has been, over the last couple of years, I would say, an increased interest in focusing on defections from Al-Shabaab. I mean, that's Al-Shabaab's former spokesman. You know, he was a high-ranking member of Al-Shabaab, Mukhtar Robo, defected a couple of years ago. And, you know, I point out in the piece that was kind of horribly botched by the federal government of Somalia, because he ended up wanting to run for president of his federal member state. So Somalia is a federation. So rather than provinces or states, they're called federal member states, and their governors are called presidents. So he was running for president of his home state, and you know, he probably wasn't going to win. You know, folks I talked to, you know, sort of knew the backroom stuff, that, you know, because it wasn't a popular election, that he didn't have the backroom support, but he had a lot of popular support, and the federal government kind of panicked and just arrested him. And so that sends, you know, a really awful signal to Al-Shabaab. But at the same time, there was a former Al-Shabaab leader who is the president of the southernmost state, Jubaland, Ahmed Badobe. You know, and he is a there is an entire annex in the UN monitoring group for Somalia for the sanctions on Madobe's subordinates and the human rights abuses they've committed. So we do business with you know, pretty awful guys. You know, that's out there. So, you know, really what we need to present to Al-Shabaab is Ahmed Badobe. You know, this is the best end state you can get. You can, you know, become a regional president. You know, maybe eventually you can even run for, you know, prime minister or federal president. You know, Ahmed Badobe controls one of the biggest ports in Somalia, so, you know, he's collecting all kinds of rents from that. So, you know, life is pretty good for him. And if you offer that to Shabaab and, you know, you don't have the threat of American drones hunting you, that's not necessarily a bad deal. So, you know, I have no doubt there's going to be irreconcilables. And, you know, I don't even, if I was putting percentages on this, like, I don't even know if I would say that I would bet over 50% that Al-Shabaab would negotiate, because it's an unknown, because we just haven't tried. But my point is we should try. And, you know, in having spent pretty much my entire adult life in wars, and studying it academically, I mean, ending conflicts is really hard. It's one of the hardest things in human society. So to me, you know, it's important to always just still take a shot. And, you know, right now the courses we've been taking aren't working. And so it's worthwhile to, you know, at least make a tentative, attempt to reach out and figure out a new solution.
Hang on just one second. Hey, guys, I got to tell you about WallStreetWindow.com. It's the great Mike Swanson. He made a killing on Wall Street back in the day, and now he sells advice for reasonable prices. You need to know what to do to protect your assets. WallStreetWindow.com. Well, so back in 2008, they, you know, I guess essentially time was running out on the Bush administration. And so Condoleezza Rice made a deal with Sheikh Sharif, I guess his name was, who was had been the leader of the Islamic Courts Union and said, okay, you can be the president after all. What the hell? Never mind the last 2 years of fighting here. You can be the president, but it can't be the Islamic Courts Union anymore. It has to be, you have to take the job inside the transitional federal government that we've created for you. And he said, okay, and took her up on that offer. But then Al-Shabaab, the youth, said, ha, you're a traitor, and turned on him, and I guess whatever parts of the Islamic Courts Union had gone with him, and stayed at war back then. So,
yeah, I mean, part of that also is because there was an Ethiopian occupation,
right?
Which, you know, is one of the more disastrous decisions I think the Bush administration made in Africa in supporting the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia in 2007, because that sort of stirred up all this national sentiment, because the only war Somalia fought as a state, as a modern state, was against Ethiopia. So having, you know, the largest state existential threat next to you invade is a pretty good way to ensure that there's going to not be a lot of popular support for the government that, you know, that force is propping up.
And with a Christian versus Muslim dynamic added as well. But so now the AU forces there don't include the Ethiopians anymore, or they do still?
There are Ethiopians. Uh-huh. So Ethiopians are part of that force. And the Ethiopians are kind of an interesting case because the Ethiopians have a huge Somali population. You know, the Oromo region, or excuse me, the Ogaden region of Somalia, or excuse me, of Ethiopia is, you know, predominantly Ogaden clan Somali.
Mm-hmm.
So they understand clan politics very well, and their sector, there's not a ton of fighting, largely because they just figure out accommodation. So I actually think Ethiopia would be a really important member of the negotiating team. I have no doubt that they have rather extensive, they also have a pretty good intelligence service. I have no doubt they've got extensive contacts with Al-Shabaab.
Let me rephrase it then. So if Condoleezza Rice had essentially made the same kind of effort you're talking about now, you think that possibly could have been more successful and Al-Shabaab maybe could have been brought in then?
Possibly. So there's another point I want to make too, and this, you know, may be a separate piece I'll work on with a Somali-American colleague, is we didn't even get into the Somali politics piece of this. And, I mean, Somali politics is really hard. It's really fractious. It's why, you know, even if the Islamic Courts Union or Al-Shabaab had won, my guess is their ruling coalition would break down really quickly, just because Somali politics makes the country very hard to govern. It's why, you know, sort of the international community sort of encouraged the Somali government to adopt a federated system, which, you know, I think is the right approach. But Somali politics could absolutely torpedo all of this. You know, it's sort of a huge unknown. I don't think, you know, I would be the first to admit, having spent 2 years, I do not understand Somali politics very well. They've been doing conflict politics for 30 years now. They understand it way better than we do, and you know, we're often going to be taken advantage of in that process.
I mean, well, that's a great point. I mean, it seems like, based on that wisdom alone, the best answer our side could come up with would be to let them decentralize power as much as possible. The more you centralize it, the more central power there is to fight over, and the more important it is whoever rules not just Mogadishu and its port, but the rest of the country too, then that's the power to abuse, the golden ring everybody wants to get their hands on, but just give everybody little brass ones instead, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, Somalia could be in a libertarian paradise at some point. You guys, you know, may want to move Mogadishu.
What's funny is, you know,
ever gets the ideal.
It's really interesting that you say that, because
their ideology.
This is a really important point. I think that, you know, this is a I'm not accusing you, but it's what you're referring to anyway. Is this is a kind of a libertarian talking point that freedom works so well as a system, property rights and all that? Then why don't you just move to Somalia where they're so free? As though we don't know that the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command started their business in Somalia before New Year. Years 2001. It was one of the first battlegrounds in the war on terrorism. The CIA was backing these warlords, which is the conflict that led to the rise of the Islamic Courts Union in the first place, and then backed the Ethiopian invasion, as you said. But guess what? Before all of that, in the very late 1990s, and before the September 11th attack, which no Somali had anything to do with, by the way, they actually had essentially no government, and it wasn't because they believed in libertarian property rights theory or whatever, it was because all the warlords were so exhausted that none of them were powerful enough to really consolidate control. And it was actually the uncles and the old men and the real sort of bottom-up civil society types were the ones hearing the court cases, as you kind of talk about in here, that al-Shabaab does better conflict resolution than the competition when it comes to dealing with the civilians on the ground. And that kind of thing was breaking out all over, and their economy was booming, and there were real serious studies by academic economists and all these people showing that it was one of the fastest-growing economies in all of Africa at the time. And it really wasn't until American intervention came and put an end to all that that everything turned to chaos. And then everyone blames freedom for the chaos.
Yeah, there's certainly some nostalgia about Somalia before 2001. There is some good scholarship out there. Ken Mankow, has sort of
Great guy. Uh-huh.
Government without governance. But the one thing I would quibble with that piece is he's looking at like two case studies.
I mean, they were coming up from communism. So, again, this wasn't like anarcho-capitalist paradise. This was just the very best they'd ever had it. That's all.
Yeah. I do think there's a lot of interesting case studies. And one of the reasons I was drawn to working in Somalia is this decentralized model I think one of the big, a more academic piece that I'm working on right now is, when we get involved in interventions like this, you're kind of trying to impose a technocratic state-building solution on a process that's inherently very violent. State formation is before the world wars, literally the most violent human process in history. People can argue over the benefits of the centralized state that you get on the back end. But what I don't think you can argue is that it's going to be a violent conflict. When you start to take more taxes, there are going to be lots of business groups and interest groups, or consolidate, coercive power. There's going to be, say warlords that don't want to give that up, and you're eventually some of them are going to be killed because they're going to sort, that dispute out via arms. I think one of the questions the international community needs to ask is, do we want to be part of this violent, state formation process? And if the answer is no, then we need to think about how we support more decentralized solutions. I think Somalia is the perfect test case of that. Somalia, the political ideology of Somalia just sort of lends itself towards decentralization. If you look at Somaliland, it's very relative, but Somaliland and then Puntland, which is a semi-autonomous state in Somalia, but still technically part of Somalia, whereas Somaliland has tried to secede. They're relatively peaceful. I mean, Puntland is seeing some increased violence from the Islamic State and al-Shabaab now, but, Somaliland, it's not a place you necessarily want to live. You're from the West, but, I visited Somaliland. It's fine. It's nice climate. And in Hargeisa, the capital city, and it's a functioning state.
Do you have an email list, Jason, for your writings?
So I've only got this one piece out published right now. So, okay. I'm working on some other.
I'd be very interested to read the next one. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I really have to move on to my next guest here. I'm running late. But,
absolutely.
But I definitely would like to stay in contact with you about that next one, too. And I really appreciate your time on the show today. It's been great.
Yeah, great conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. And I'm sorry we have to go because there's so much more here, but maybe we'll talk again next time.
Absolutely.
All right, you guys.
Yeah,
that is Jason Hartwig. He's a veteran of the U.S. Army in Iraq War II and Afghanistan, and he worked for the U.S. mission to Somalia as a military assistance coordinator. And this one is at waronthrocks.com. It's called How to End the Civil War in Somalia. Negotiate with al-Shabaab. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/scotthortonshow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.